Thanks for coming. I'm glad we have better weather than when we tried to do this in February. I want to start by thanking the Academy for lowering its standards enough to enable me to become a member. Also for organizing the event. Thanks to Leslie for inviting me to give this talk. Thanks very much to Randy for agreeing to enter into a conversation. I have to apologize if I'm seeming a little bit distracted tonight. I'm flying to Fort Myers on Friday for Red Sox spring training, and I haven't been able to think about anything else for the last month. Don't tell my con law students that. It might get me in trouble with my dean, but it's true. I'm going to talk to you tonight about the Supreme Court and race. I'm going to give you a brief historical overview, and then I'm mostly going to focus on developments in the last 40 years since 1970. There'll be a few takeaway lines after I offer my description, and I'm going to try to get this done within 30 minutes so that there'll be plenty of time for some discussion with Randy and then questions from the audience. So I want to start with a conventional wisdom, and then I want to try to debunk that conventional wisdom. The conventional wisdom is that the Supreme Court is a heroic defender of the rights of racial minorities. That's because the justices are somewhat insulated from politics. They're not directly politically accountable. That allows them to have some element of independence and enables them to protect minority groups against majoritarian oppression. I want to challenge this idea that the court has historically played this role. Indeed, I want to argue to the contrary, that the Supreme Court, more often than not, has been a foe rather than a friend of racial minorities in general and African Americans specifically. Before the Civil War, the United States Supreme Court upheld federal fugitive slave laws against constitutional challenge. The court struck down northern state personal liberty laws that tried to protect African Americans from kidnapping. In the famous Dred Scott case in 1857, the court both held that Congress lacked the constitutional power to restrict the spread of slavery into federal territories, and the court held that even free blacks did not have any rights that white people were bound to respect. During and after Reconstruction, the court invalidated federal civil rights legislation. The court allowed perpetrators of racial massacres and lynchings of African Americans to go free on legal technicalities. Well into the 20th century, the Supreme Court generally upheld laws segregating the races and sustained Southern state measures addressed toward the disfranchisement of African Americans. It's really Brown versus Board of Education in 1954 and its immediate progeny that are responsible for this romantic image we have of the Supreme Court as a savior of the interests of African Americans. Now, to be sure, the court's ruling in 1954, which struck down state-mandated segregation in public education, was of enormous symbolic importance to African Americans. Many contemporary African American newspapers referred to Brown as the most important event for blacks since the Emancipation Proclamation. By making Jim Crow seem more vulnerable, the Brown decision raised the hopes and expectations of African Americans and thus helped to catalyze the transformative civil rights change that came in the 1960s. Yet, one should not exaggerate the contribution that the Supreme Court made to progressive change in the 1960s. The Brown decision reflected social and political changes with regard to race at least as much as the decision made such changes possible. The ruling would not have been conceivable without the tremendous impetus for racial change provided by World War II. The anti-fascist ideology of the war, the contributions made by black soldiers to this war for democracy, the increasing migration of African Americans from the rural South to the urban North, where they exerted much greater political influence, and finally, the Cold War imperative for racial change that followed the war, that is, the perceived importance for the United States to eradicate Jim Crow as a way of appealing to third world nations, which are mostly non-white, to side with democratic capitalism in the battle with communism. All of those forces laid the groundwork for the Supreme Court's decision in Brown. Moreover, the court followed its bold pronouncement in the Brown 1 decision in 1954 with a ruling that was so weak and vacillating in Brown 2 in 1955 that I think the court actually led white Southerners to believe that it was possible to intimidate the justices into eventually backing down from their decision. After Brown 2, the Supreme Court essentially vacated the field for the better part of a decade. The justices apparently concluded that they did not have sufficient backing in public opinion or from the president or from Congress, and they concluded that they had no useful role to play until that sort of support was forthcoming. There was no such immediate show of support. As a result, as late as 1964, a full decade after the decision in Brown, as few as 1 or 2 in 100 African-American schoolchildren were attending integrated schools. 1964, a full decade after the Brown decision. Now, as the direct action phase of the civil rights movement, the sit-ins, the freedom rides, the street demonstrations began to sweep the nation in the early 1960s, the Supreme Court re-entered the fold. The court again exerted itself both with regard to school desegregation specifically and with regard to other racial issues more generally. In 1963, the court warned that the desegregation context had been significantly altered from what it was in 1954-1955, and that desegregation plans that might have been deemed sufficient 8 or 9 years earlier no longer would necessarily be so. In 1964, the justices ruled that school closures taken for the purpose of avoiding desegregation orders were unconstitutional. And in 1968, the justices, in a case out of Virginia, held that the constitutionality of school desegregation plans would depend not on whether they formally desegregated the schools, but whether they actually achieved a significant measure of racial integration. During the 1960s, the court also went to great lengths to overturn the criminal conviction of sit-in demonstrators. The court created new constitutional law to protect the NAACP against legal harassment by Southern states. The court expanded the range of private actors which are bound by the anti-discrimination provisions of the 14th Amendment, and the court upheld broad exercises of congressional power on behalf of civil rights. In addition, the Warren Court justices revolutionized the rules of criminal procedure, and criminal defendants disproportionately belong to racial minority groups. And the court also radically transformed the law of federal courts because the justices no longer believed that Southern state judges could be entrusted with fairly dealing with the civil rights of Southern blacks and whites. For this short decade of the 1960s, the court came about as close as it ever has to realizing this image of heroic protector of racial minorities. Then, just as the civil rights movement reached its zenith, shifting social and political forces disrupted racial progress. Opinion polls had shown that civil rights was the predominant issue on the national agenda from the spring or summer of 1963 through the spring of 1964, but at that point, the Vietnam War displaced it from the number one issue on Gallup polls. Moreover, as civil rights leaders began to shift their focus from the South to the North and broaden their agenda to include economic empowerment, many previously sympathetic whites lost their enthusiasm for the movement. Less than 6 weeks after President Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act into law, a race riot erupted in the Watts neighborhood of Los Angeles, killing 34 people, and that proved to be the harbinger of dozens of other race riots in American cities later in the 1960s. By the mid to late 1960s, black nationalism, which often eschewed racial integration as a goal and nonviolence as a tactic, was sowing divisions within the civil rights community and souring many white Americans on racial reform. Indeed, one can see the white voter backlash erupting as early as 1964 in national politics. That's the year the Republican Party nominated Barry Goldwater for the presidency. Barry Goldwater was a vocal opponent of that year's Civil Rights Act, and in the 1964 election, he won five Deep South states and his home state of Arizona, beginning, accelerating a transformation in national politics that we still see to the present day. Blacks deserted the party of Lincoln in droves, and those whites most committed to the preservation of white supremacy switched 100 years after the Civil War from being reliable Democrats into being reliable Republicans. By 1966, a racial backlash was appearing in the North as urban race riots, proposals for fair housing legislation, and demands by African Americans for economic empowerment were starting to sunder the Civil Rights Coalition. In 1968, Republican presidential candidate Richard Nixon won the presidency on a platform of a domestic platform of law and order, a reduced relaxed pace of school desegregation, and an end to busing. 97% of African Americans voted for Hubert Humphrey in 1968. Only 35% of whites did so. The 14% of voters who supported the notoriously racist George Wallace, who was running on an independent party ticket, those people, those 14%, provided an additional future temptation for the Republican Party to move even further to the right on race issues. Nixon's victory at the polls translated directly into changes in the court's racial jurisprudence. He got four new appointments to the court during his first term. Nixon's appointees quickly made themselves felt with regard to the court's racial jurisprudence. In 1974, the Supreme Court decided in its most important race decision, most important school desegregation since Brown, a case out of Detroit called Milliken versus Bradley. The court ruled by a 5-4 vote that largely white suburban school districts could not be drawn into an urban desegregation decree unless there was proof that school district lines had been drawn with the deliberate purpose of preserving racial segregation. As a result of this decision, federal courts were disabled from accomplishing meaningful desegregation in most American cities. In most American cities, whites were fleeing the cities to the suburbs. It was not possible to have meaningful desegregation if you walled off the suburban school districts from the urban district. Nixon's appointees were four of the five justices in the majority in Milliken versus Bradley. On another issue of tremendous racial importance, the Berger Court ruled in a case called Washington versus Davis in 1976 that laws that did not make a racial classification, that is, laws that on their face say nothing about race, those laws would receive heightened judicial scrutiny, the most intensive form of judicial review, only if the plaintiff could prove that they had been motivated by a discriminatory racial purpose. It was not sufficient to show that those laws simply had a disparate impact on racial minorities. So to give you an example of what's implicated by that decision, as a result of that ruling, federal sentencing guidelines that prescribe precisely the same punishment for possessing 5 grams of powder cocaine as 5 grams of crack cocaine as for possessing 500 grams of powder cocaine, those laws have survived constitutional challenge, even though 90% of the crack defendants are black and 3/4 of the powder defendants are white. An enormous disparate racial impact, but under the Supreme Court's racial jurisprudence, not unconstitutional unless you can show that a discriminatory racial animus is what produced the law. In the 1978 Bakke decision, the Berger Court narrowly ruled that race-based affirmative action policies would be subject to the same strict judicial scrutiny as traditional Jim Crow legislation. Conservative justices then and since have read the 14th Amendment as a command of colorblindness. That's a 14th Amendment that was adopted for the purpose of guaranteeing civil rights of recently freed slaves. These justices have read it to mandate colorblindness in the context of racially motivated measures designed to redress past discrimination. The court's overall record on race-based affirmative action is mixed. Since the Bakke decision, the conservative justices have almost invariably voted to strike down affirmative action measures, while the liberal justices have almost always voted to reject constitutional challenges to those measures. Individual case outcomes have been determined by the swing justices, first Justice Lewis Powell, then Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, but it would be fair to say the court has invalidated more affirmative action laws than it has sustained. This hostility of the conservative justices to race-based affirmative action reflects what I would call a constitutional double standard. These are the same justices who ordinarily, for example, in cases involving abortion, cases involving gay rights or physician-assisted suicide, profess commitments to judicial restraint, to democratic decision-making, respect for states' rights, and a commitment to a constitutional methodology of textualism and originalism. Yet all of those considerations point in the favor of the court permitting race-based affirmative action. When the court strikes down affirmative action programs, it is unelected justices striking down the democratically chosen policies of state and local governments, and they are doing it on a thin constitutional basis. The text of the 14th Amendment doesn't say anything about government colorblindness, and the original understanding of the 14th Amendment, which these justices ordinarily profess a commitment to abiding by, does not mandate colorblindness. The people who wrote the 14th Amendment and their constituents were actually, perhaps ironically, too racist to support a complete ban on government racial classifications. We know, for example, that they thought that laws disenfranchising blacks were not forbidden by the 14th Amendment. That's why a 15th Amendment was necessary a couple of years later. They did not believe that excluding blacks from jury service violated the 14th Amendment, and they did not believe that laws forbidding interracial marriage or laws mandating segregation of schools violated the 14th Amendment. It is impossible, I would submit to you, to derive from the 14th Amendment a mandate for government colorblindness. The Rehnquist Court, which succeeded the Berger Court, pretty consistently ruled against the interest of racial minorities, although most of its decisions were divided narrowly along partisan lines. Since Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush appointed five new justices to the court between 1981 and 1991, conservatives have enjoyed a secure majority on almost all racial issues, although interestingly, not on many other issues such as abortion, gay rights, the death penalty, or the separation of church and state. By 1991, the last 10 appointments to the Supreme Court had been made by Republican presidents, none of whom garnered much more than 10% of the African American vote in their presidential election victories. It was the Rehnquist Court, the Rehnquist Conservatives Court, which sounded the death knell for court-ordered school desegregation. In a case from Oklahoma City in 1991, a narrowly divided court ruled that once a school district had complied in good faith for a reasonable period of time with a court-ordered desegregation decree, and if it had eliminated to the extent practicable the past effects of deliberate state-sponsored discrimination, then the school district was entitled to be released from its court-ordered desegregation decree. If terminating a desegregation decree under those circumstances resulted in increased school segregation, which it almost invariably did, then private housing preferences were responsible, the conservative majority said, and you could not fairly ascribe responsibility to the ensuing school segregation to the government. In 1995, the conservative justices indicated that their tolerance for alternative remedies, alternative to busing, alternative remedial decrees involving increased funding to compensate for past discrimination, that those were also unlikely to satisfy the court's scrutiny. In a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court forbade the use of magnet school programs for the purpose of enticing suburban whites back into urban schools, and the justices imposed virtually insurmountable obstacles to judicially mandated increases in educational financing as a remedy for school segregation. In addition to curbing court-ordered school desegregation and race-based affirmative action, the Rehnquist Court's conservative majority inaugurated a new strand of constitutional jurisprudence that called into question the permissibility of legislative districts that had been deliberately gerrymandered to enhance the ability of racial minorities to elect representatives of their own race. As with the conservative justices' posture toward affirmative action, these decisions are very difficult to reconcile with the original understanding of the 14th Amendment, which quite clearly was meant not to cover political rights, but only the civil rights that distinguished former slaves from free persons. Perhaps most disturbing, the Rehnquist Court has proved largely indifferent to race discrimination in the criminal justice system. In a 1987 decision called McCleskey versus Kemp, the conservative justices narrowly rejected, again, a 5-4 decision. They rejected an equal protection challenge to the discriminatory administration of the death penalty in the state of Georgia. Specifically, according to a study that the justices stipulated they were accepting the validity of for purposes of the litigation, defendants who murdered whites were 4.3 times more likely to get the death penalty in Georgia than defendants who had murdered blacks. In other words, Georgia was essentially devaluing the lives of its African-American citizens by refusing to administer the death penalty as aggressively when it was blacks who had been killed as opposed to whites. Rejecting the constitutional challenge, the court said that race discrimination could not possibly be entirely eliminated from the administration of the death penalty as long as actors who were integral to the administration of the death penalty, like jurors and prosecutors, continued to exercise significant discretion. And the majority also noted that similar racial disparities probably existed throughout the criminal justice system, which meant that vindicating McCleskey's claims would have profound consequences throughout the system. One might have thought that that observation made McCleskey's claims more compelling, but the court thought they made them less compelling. In 2007, another slim conservative majority brought the court's racial jurisprudence full circle from Brown. In 1954, the court had ruled that state-mandated racial segregation in public schools violated the 14th Amendment. In 2007, the conservative majority, in an opinion written by the new Chief Justice John Roberts, ruled that for school districts to take race into account in order to promote the goal of racial integration violated that same 14th Amendment. Now, the conservative majority in this 2007 case, which is known as Parents Involved, they did not talk about the text or original understanding of the Constitution. They talked about a supposed mandate for colorblindness, but they did not try to root it in the text or original understanding, probably because, as I've already suggested, it is almost impossible to root such an understanding in the text or original intent. Instead, the conservative justices relied mostly on Brown versus Board of Education and extraordinarily on the NAACP's argument to the Supreme Court in Brown, which is an unusual source of constitutional interpretation, to say the least. I can't think of other examples where the Supreme Court relies on the arguments that a past litigant made to the court in a prior case as a source of constitutional interpretation. Now, Brown, of course, does not have to be read as a mandate for government colorblindness. Indeed, it can just as easily be interpreted to forbid only those racial classifications that were adopted for the purpose or that have the effect of subordinating traditionally disadvantaged racial groups. It's true that the NAACP in Brown did argue, at least in portions of its brief, for government colorblindness, but that's not what the court gave the NAACP. The justices in 1954 were too wary of striking down anti-miscegenation laws. That was an especially explosive issue in the mid-1950s when opinion polls showed that 90% of the country, North as well as South, opposed interracial marriages. The justices were too worried about striking down bans on interracial marriage to give the NAACP a flat-out ban on racial classifications. Moreover, the conservative justices in 2007 were taking the NAACP's argument in Brown badly out of context. The NAACP had argued for government colorblindness in the context of a system of formal Jim Crow white supremacy. To portray the NAACP as repudiating race-conscious government efforts to redress past discrimination, to promote racial diversity, in a setting where nobody could have dreamed of legislatures adopting such measures, which is the case in the 1950s, I think that is quite disingenuous. I would draw three lessons from this brief historical journey that I've just led you through. What should we conclude from the last 40 years? First of all, most of these rulings were 5-4. Had there been one more liberal justice, many, if not most, of these decisions would have come out differently. Thus, it was not in any sense predestined that the United States Supreme Court would, for the most part, reject race-based affirmative action, prematurely terminate the school desegregation project, or reject the argument that the Constitution bars not only discriminatory purposes, but also racially disparate impacts. Constitutional interpretation, I would suggest, necessarily implicates judicial discretion. Judicial discretion reflects political ideology, and conservative justices tend, not surprisingly, to reflect the conservative racial ideology of the party that appointed them. That ideology embraces a narrow, formalist understanding of what counts as race discrimination. It abhors the use of racial preferences, whether they are benignly motivated or not, and it deems this nation's ugly history of racial oppression as something more to be repudiated than to be remedied. Second, while the political composition of the United States Supreme Court is to some extent fortuitous, the victories of the conservative bloc of justices since 1970 has predominantly been a function of politics. Between 1969 and 2008, Republicans controlled the presidency for 28 years, Democrats only for 12. Of the 14 appointments made to the United States Supreme Court between 1969 and 2006, 12 of them were made by Republican presidents, most of whom prided themselves on their conservative politics. Because constitutional interpretation is so inextricably linked with politics, I don't think we should be very surprised that justices who were appointed by presidents for whom very few black people voted would decide race-inflected cases in ways that contravene the preferences of most African Americans. Third and finally, I think one has to wonder at least a little bit how much difference it would have made had the liberal justices had their way and had the decisions come out in the direction that the liberal justices would have favored. Public opposition to busing the suburbs was so intense by the early 1970s. Think, for example, of the race riots that erupted in Boston in 1974, Boston, the so-called cradle of abolitionism, that it's a little bit hard to believe if the Supreme Court had come out the other way in Milliken versus Bradley and approved of judicial busing of the suburbs, that the justices could have made that decision stick. It's quite plausible that there would have been a constitutional amendment or that there would have been massive defiance of such a decision. A conservative majority of justices, it's true, has managed to invalidate most affirmative action policies that have reached the court. But even when the liberals have won an occasional triumph, such as the University of Michigan Law School case from 2003, that result has been overturned at the polls, as it was in a referendum in Michigan a couple years later, because most Americans seem inclined, when asked to vote on the topic, they seem inclined to vote against race-based preferences. Similarly, by the time the court in 2007 struck down school board policies that took race into account with the aim of promoting integration, by the time the court struck those down, only 5 to 10% of school districts in the country had such policies. Most of the country had already given up on racial integration in grade schools. So to sum this up, in the last 40 years of conservative hegemony on the court, we have had consistently racially regressive results pretty much across the board, but one should not absolve the larger society that the court serves of its share of responsibility for those outcomes. The United States Supreme Court mirrors American society at least as much as it shapes it. The conservative justices could not have foisted this conservative racial jurisprudence on the American people without their acquiescence. Thank you very much.